Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. Welcome to Afternoons with me. I'm Bill Arnold. Here's a verse that's been ringing in my head all day. I love this verse, Psalm 3, verse 3. But you are a shield around me, O Lord. You bestow glory on me and lift up my head. Wow. You bestow glory on me, little old me. You lift up my head? Wow, I love that. We have a great show for you today. Michael and Una Ireland will be joining me in just a minute. Then I will also be talking to Kylie Crossland from World News. And then Dr. Alex McFarland will be joining me. And then in the second hour, Afshin Ziafat. He's from Iran. He's got a powerful story. You're going to love the show today, as I'm excited to bring it to you. Thank you for listening and to supporting Faith Radio. Let me take 60 seconds, and I'll get Michael and Una Ireland on the program.
Statesman Edmund Burke is noted for saying the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Now, that statement should encourage all of us to engage in culture and be the salt and light Jesus calls us to be. But Burke also said this, nobody made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could only do a little. Now, could I suggest that many who listen to Faith Radio have that perspective when it comes to supporting this ministry? Believing a small gift doesn't make a difference, they don't get involved. As Burke says, this is a great mistake. Faith Radio is fueled by many gifts that might be considered small by today's standards. $20, $30, or $40 single gifts, or $10 or $20 a month. Each of these gifts, when combined with the others, form the foundation on which this outreach is built. So thanks for your willingness to do something rather than nothing. Because of your gifts, the gospel goes out and lives are changed. Make your gift, whatever the size, today at myfaithradio.com.
It is awfully nice to have Michael and Una Ireland in my studio right now. Michael is an internet journalist serving as chief correspondent of the Assist News Service. He's also an ordained minister serving as a chaplain volunteer at several assisted living facilities. He has covered stories for Assist News Service in places like Mexico, Jamaica, Nicaragua, Israel, Jordan, China, and Russia. He writes about the persecuted church around the world, and his lovely wife, Una, and him have two adult daughters. And Una has lived, ready for this, for more than 50 years with an implanted pacemaker defibrillator. Wow. And she survived a sudden cardiac arrest nearly 15 years ago and was on life support in a medically induced coma and was not expected to live. I love the power of prayer in this story already, and I don't even know it. Michael, Una, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I know that you've got a couple different hats you wear. Michael, let's talk a little bit about working and covering the persecuted church.
Well, I've been doing this for about 30 years now. This is my 30th year.
Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you. I started out actually on a local newspaper in London, England. And the story behind that is my mother was doing housework for a retired Christian school teacher, Olive B. Knight. And she, my mom would sit down with Olive Knight halfway through her shift of house cleaning. And Miss Knight would say, Michael, what do you want to be when you grow up? And people are still asking me that, by the way. And I said, well, I'd love to be a journalist. And she said, well, I just happen to know a journalist. He goes to my church, St. John's Church in Ealing, West London. And his name was Dan Wooding. So when I came home from boarding school at Reading Bluecoat School in Reading, Berkshire, I came for half term. It's like spring break, except we don't go to the beach. So we had coffee at a coffee shop just around the corner from the Middlesex County Times newspaper, where Dan was the chief reporter. And we went out on a reporting assignment.
Wow.
It was to go to a block of flats where a lady had some bugs in her apartment, and she was trying to get the local city council that owned the building to defumigate.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dan took me along on this assignment, and he let me ask a question.
Wow.
And wow, that was dangerous.
What was your question? Why are the bugs bothering you?
Yes.
That's what I would have asked.
Why are you bugged by the bugs?
Exactly.
And so I knew then that I was actually bitten by the journalism bug.
Yeah.
And so Dan eventually helped me get a cub reporter position on the Middlesex County Times, and we worked together for several years. He went on to bigger and better things, into Fleet Street, which was then at that time the one road in London, England, where all the big newspapers had their offices. He also became a correspondent for the National Enquirer. He's the only man I know that's worked for both Billy Graham and the National Enquirer. But that's just an aside.
Yeah, that's a fun fact.
So when I left boarding school, I went into the civil service, the British civil service. And you have to say that with a stiff upper lip.
Mm-hmm.
British Civil Service, because the careers master at my boarding school, who didn't like me and I didn't like him, he said, "No, you'll never make a journalist." He said, "You should go into the civil service." And I tried that, and I was bored to tears. I was absolutely bored. And I saw this advertisement for an editorial assistant trainee journalist at Brennard's Press Air News Service, London Heathrow Airport.
Nice.
And I was there for a while. I was a copy taker. And I sat in the booth with headphones and would take down stories from the reporters on the airfield. And I was there a little while until Dan and I connected on a more friendly level, you know, on a professional level. And he said, "You know, Michael, if you really want to work in newspapers, I'll try and get you a job." And we had this editor called Bert Monday, not M-O-N-D-A-Y, but M-U-N-D-A-Y, Bert Monday. And he was a tap dancing editor. He would sing and tap dance on the phone.
Hmm.
Yeah, I can see you.
Fascinated by Bert Monday. I've never met him. So,
and he would sing and dance while on the phone. And he said to me, "Well, I'll hire you. I'll give you a chance, but you'll never be another Dan Wooding." And he gave me a break because I didn't have all the necessary qualifications to be a journalist in England. You needed 5 GCSE O levels and 2 A levels. And that would get you into college normally in England. And I didn't have those. And he said, "Well, I'm going to give you a break, you know, but don't let me down." Well, this editor didn't like me that much. He thought I was, you know, a bit of a fly-by-night, a little cocky, and so he gave me a rough time. And although I was indentured as a journalist, and that's the old system of the tradesman, where you could be indentured as a young electrician or a carpenter. Sure. They did this in journalism in those days,
like,
in Britain. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I signed legal documents and I became indentured, and that was a legally binding agreement. And I broke that legally binding agreement. So they're still after me now.
Yeah.
But I'm in Minnesota, so they'll never find me.
Yeah. And the fact that you haven't taken your sunglasses off yet, I know you're kind of on the lam.
Yeah, they can't see my sunglasses
exactly.
on radio, right?
Exactly,
yeah.
Of course not.
Yeah, I'm incognito.
Yes.
And it really disappointed me that I failed at journalism at 18, 19 years old. And I went into the civil service, and that didn't go so well either. I was under a lot of pressure, and I had a nervous breakdown. And there was no room in the hospital for me, no hospital bed, so I was living at my parents' for 4 weeks, and all I did was eat, sleep, drink, take my medication, eat, sleep, drink, and take my medication. And so I went back to work, and I thought, what am I going to do with my life? I've kind of messed up here. And I thought, well, at some point, I'd like to go to Bible college or Bible school, and maybe having some training in Bible and getting comfort and exhortation from the Word would really help me out. So I said to the employer at this public corporation I was in, the civil service, I said, "Can you give me a leave of absence to go to Bible school?" And they said, "What good will that do us?" And I said, "It'll make me a better employee."
Hmm.
Well, they said no, so I quit anyway. And I went to Cape and Ray Bible School in the north of England, which was in the Lake District of northern England. And it's Cape and Ray Missionary Fellowship of Torchbearers. And it was started by Dr. Major Ian Thomas. And he
I love Ian Thomas.
Love Ian Thomas.
Oh, I love Ian Thomas.
Yes, he can talk faster than I can.
Yes, he can.
Yeah.
So you know his story that he,
yes, I do.
After World War II, he started the Kefenrey schools for, basically in Germany for the German youth that was so disappointed after World War II. Well, I went to the Kefenrey school in England. Now, here's where my story turns around. There were 200 students from 22 different countries, and there were some Americans there. The Americans, they get everywhere.
You know,
Americans get everywhere. And the short story is that I made friends with a couple of Americans, and they invited me to come to the U.S. and be their house guest. And that's when things really started picking up for me, or getting worse, whichever you want to say, because I decided I'd like to move to America. And I applied to Bethel, Northwestern, North Central, and Spebe, St. Paul Bible College, now Crown College. And I was accepted at Crown College, and immigration wouldn't change my visa. They said, no, basically. And they sent me back home to London, and I had my second nervous breakdown. I'm working on my 19th nervous breakdown, in case you're counting.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I went back home to England. That time I was 4 weeks in the hospital. They actually had a bed for me this time. And I got out after 4 weeks, and I said to my dad, "Dad, will you give me your blessing to go back to America?" And he said, "No." So I came anyway, and I got to St. Paul Bible College, now Crown College, December 29th, 1982, and there was 16 inches of snow that day. 16 inches. I wanted to turn around and get back on the plane. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad I didn't, because after I was there one semester and one summer, a young blue-eyed blonde walked into my life.
Yeah. Is this the one that's sitting to your right now?
Yeah, my right, your left.
Yeah. My left. Yeah.
And so there's more to that story. But did you want to ask me another question, or should I keep going?
Well, we're going to take a break here in just about a minute. So far, I'm fascinated with all the God appointments in your life.
Because you
go one direction, and God says, let's autocorrect here. Let's go this direction.
Yeah,
and you keep making bold moves, which is something that's an encouragement for all of us.
Thank you.
Take risks, make bold moves, and God is leading you on a very interesting path. So we are going to take a short break. Michael Ireland and his wife, Una, are my guests. Michael's a chief correspondent for Assist News Service after he was told he'd never make it in journalism. So there you go. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm so glad I've got in my studio Michael and Una Ireland. And Michael is a chief correspondent of the Assist News Service. He's also an ordained minister, and he's a chaplain. And he has covered stories about the persecuted church all over the world. So, Michael, let's get to the meat of this discussion, where you meet Una.
Yes.
That's where things get interesting.
Yes, they do. Una used to like to play cards, Uno specifically,
Una?
And she played Uno.
Uno, okay.
And she liked to play cards in the lobby of Crown College, which was then St. Paul Bible College, and she liked to take her shoes off to relax and play cards.
Mm-hmm.
Along comes little Brit me, seeing the shoes and the blue-eyed blonde, and I take her shoes and put them out in the snow. I knew I
this
was...
This is called flirting? Because this is another bad choice you've made.
I was trying to be subtle.
Okay. All right.
Anyway, this young lady would say to me, please go and get my shoes back. And then I thought, oh, she's got this nice smile. And she's got pleasant attitude, you know, fairly nice personality. And she's pretty, you know, pretty nice. And so I tried to find her. After we went for a little walk, there was another Brit lady there, and she tried to get us together. This Brit lady tried to get Una and myself together. And Una came by one other time, and this other friend said, why don't you and Micah go for a walk? And it was raining, and I had a very old heavy jacket and I had a hood and I pulled it up over my head because I didn't want people to know it was me that was going
out. You're still on the run from the law.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't want people to know that I was interested in Una, so
right.
I covered up, incognito.
Okay.
And we had such an interesting walk out in the rain that the next day I tried to find her. I looked for 4 hours around the Crown College campus to find her. Well, she was in her dorm. I mean...
Yeah, you got to figure out where to look.
Yeah. And eventually... I did find her, and we went to the co-ed kitchen, and she made me ramen noodles and toast, nice. Buttered both sides.
Nice.
Yeah. From there, we went on a couple of bike rides, and then I went on spring break, which was actually down to New Mexico again, not to the beach, and came back. We got stranded in Iowa, which I guess happens to some people. And we talked on the phone. I asked her to let my profs know I'd be late back from spring break. And when I heard her voice and she said she made me some cookies, I realized that I missed her.
Ooh,
yeah,
oh, sweet.
And there was something going on there. I wanted to get back and see her. So that's when I started thinking more seriously about how she might be part of my life.
Yeah. See, I thought we were going to talk about the persecuted church. Now we're talking about a love story. I love this much better.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
So, but you did ask how we met.
I did ask that, so yes.
Yeah, and it's a very important part because Una has been my right-hand man at home, my right-hand person, my right-hand...
Lady.
Lady.
Woman.
Woman, yes.
And so then I'll shorten the story for you a little bit here. We had a long, long, long engagement, and I don't recommend that, not in the hothouse of a Christian college anyway. But we did decide to get married. We did, and we did May 17th, 1986, and I graduated in 87 and Una in 88.
Mm-hmm.
And then I reconnected with Dan Wooding, this
journalist.
British journalist, yeah. Author, broadcaster, journalist, written 40 books.
Wow.
He had worked with Brother Andrew of Open Doors, and then he went out on his own with Assist Ministries. And Assist Ministries was taking bicycles and Bibles and commentaries into Central American countries and also in Eastern Europe. And we were supporting the church. We had a sister church program where we would link, a Pentecostal church with a conservative theological church. And that was very interesting to get, you know, Baptists and Pentecostals and Catholics and Charismatics together, sister churches. Then Billy Graham came calling on Dan Wooding and asked him to go to Moscow and Puerto Rico and help him beef up his coverage of the Crusades he was having. Then Dan thought, well, if Billy Graham can use me, maybe God can use me.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started Assist News Service, and this is where it takes off. And so we had been supporting the persecuted church with clothing and bicycles and pastors' libraries and getting evangelism through envelopes. We'd write letters to pen pals and we'd say, you know, what's it like in your country? What do you think about God? I happen to live in America where, you know, I can love God freely. And we started a conversation, personal evangelism through love letters. Love tucked in an envelope is what we called it. And we carried on this kind of support for a while. And then it became obvious to us that we were journalists.
Yeah.
And that we needed to use our writing and communication gifts to help the persecuted church. So let's bring you up to, shall we say, 1989.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, and now we've got another 30 years to go through.
Well, I don't know if we have all time for 30 years, but I definitely want to hear about Una's story.
Okay.
Because this is powerful.
Well, we were sitting at home, November 22nd.
I think we should start at the beginning. In 1960... the first implanted pacemaker was put in someone. Wilson Greatbatch developed it. And I was born in 1961. practice a year after that. 1968, and my first open heart surgery to repair a hole in my heart between the valves, between the middle of the heart. And I developed a complete heart block because they had to stitch too close to my natural pacemaker.
Wow.
So that's when I got my first one.
And you've lived with a defibrillator pacemaker for 50 years?
I've lived with a pacemaker. Defibrillator came in after my cardiac arrest.
Okay. And that was about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow. God has been sustaining you for his work and your marriage and your family and everything.
Yes, he has.
What a story.
And I was able to have two children, natural childbirth.
Yeah. Ah, it's a great story.
It's a Minnesota love story.
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really is.
And to think that I didn't even like this guy first, when I first met him.
You like him now, though, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's all that matters. Yeah. And this whole stunt with the shoes and the snow, that wouldn't have gone over well at all.
No, it didn't.
No. Have you learned your lesson, Michael?
I'm trying.
Yeah.
But my wife says I'm very trying, so...
Yeah. So, what is it like knowing that this defibrillator could go off at any time?
Well, when I first got it, it was scary because I was thinking, what if it goes off? And then as I got used to having it, it didn't go off. It hasn't been off at all.
It's never gone off?
Never gone off.
Wow. That's...
It's like, we don't know if that was just a fluke. And it'll be 2004 when I had the cardiac arrest.
Okay.
Right before Thanksgiving that year. At Flatline, I was in the hospital 3 months, 6 weeks in an induced coma.
Wow. That's a long time to be in a coma.
Yeah, on life support.
That's a long time.
I wasn't expected to live.
I don't know how you would be in a coma for that long.
But while I was in that coma, it's like when I woke up from it, I was telling one of our music directors and our children's minister how I could visualize them singing to me. And I named different songs, and they said, we sang that to you right after you were in the hospital.
So they came into your room and sang? That's beautiful.
Yeah, the one song was Come Now Is the Time to Worship.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have that going through my head.
You know, I've heard this before, that when a person is in a coma state of, you know, being completely sedated in a coma, they can still hear.
Yeah.
And I heard our pastor tell Michael, no, Michael, you're fine. You can stay right there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So we had a 7th grader and a 10th grader, both girls, and the oldest called me the evil dictator. Because I said, I'm not your mom, I'm not Mr. Mom, we're going to keep going, and you girls are going to keep going to school and doing your best. You're going to do what your mom would want you to do.
Wow. Great story. It's fascinating to hear how God has been walking alongside you through your whole marriage and life and health and ministry and risk-taking, and it's just a great source of encouragement to all the listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming into the studio.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Michael and Una Ireland have been my guests. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back with lots more. It is Friday, and I love Fridays because the weekend is in front of us, although I love Mondays, so call me weird, but I seem to love every day of the week, especially when I can be with you, and I love when I get a chance to talk to Kylie Crossland. She is works for World Digital. She's a reporter that reports on marriage, family, and sexuality, and Kylie, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill. It's good to be here. Thanks
nice
for having me on.
Nice to have you back on the show as well. All right, we got a lot of stuff to cover, and you write about a lot of stuff, but let's start with what the growing trend is with the LGBT trend, which is younger Americans are finding that they're becoming less comfortable with that. That was a surprising statistic.
Super surprising. I think a lot of things I write about, you know, are expected. Like, people think, oh, man, this is the way our culture is going. This is what it should be. And I think this survey stood out to me because it was conducted by GLAAD, which is an LGBT advocacy group. So, you know, kind of from that circle. And they study every year for the last 5 years, they've studied people's comfort levels with certain LGBT situations. So like learning a family member is LGBT or learning mm-hmm. your doctor is LGBT, you know, having your child in a classroom with an LGBT teacher, these sorts of things. And every year for the first 3 years from 2014 to 2016, they saw people were more comfortable. And then the last 2 years, it's decreased. And this last year in particular, it decreased significantly for adults aged 18 to 34, which was really surprising. And you could tell they were really grappling, you know, in the study, kind of grappling for an explanation for that drop. Because the perception is that this young people in America today are more and more and more accepting. So it was really a surprising survey and stood out to me when I saw it.
And this, again, Carly, this was done by GLAAD, which is
yeah.
the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. So
right.
they're, when they get this information, they're not twisting any numbers. They're going, wow, there's I think the categories, there was a drop of 2 to 3%, which is pretty significant.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. In this last year, I mean, so they have, so these seven situations that they present people with, people that say they're very comfortable in all seven situations, they put them in kind of a category they call allies. And this percent of who is an ally for young adults, this dropped from 53% to 45% in a year. So for that young adults, it dropped, you know, 8% in a single year, which was really significant. You know, and I think striking, and they said, you know, they kind of, as an explanation for the drop, they said there's a lot of divisive rhetoric in politics and culture today, and that young people are falling prey to this, which, you know, I could be skeptical if that's really the explanation. I spoke with Andrew T. Walker. He's a fellow mm-hmm. at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, who's just kind of a cultural commentator and often has an interesting voice on these topics. And he just, you know, no one can really say, oh, I know exactly why this is happening, but he just guessed that, you know, there are more and more people kind of realizing that the LGBT movement, especially some radical parts of it, are just not sitting well with people, that there's some internal contradictions. You know, we've talked about feminism is really in contradiction to transgenderism. You can't be a feminist and believe there's women's rights if there's no such thing as a woman. And even just some like cultural fatigue, you know, oh man, should we really be beating up on all these Christians that are just trying to have small businesses in the wedding industry? You know, just that maybe there's some pushback where people are really saying, I'm not, you know, I'm kind of sympathizing more. This seems a little too harsh. You know, I'm not as comfortable as I used to be with this situation. So, but it's a really interesting study, and it'll be interesting, you know, how the results continue to develop.
Yeah. Usually there's the pendulum does swing a little bit.
Yeah.
It looks like it's doing it in this case. Let's talk about what's come out of California. Usually there's mostly bad ideas that come out of California, but,
yeah,
but
it
this report is no exception.
It is so interesting. When I look at California legislation, there's almost always a story. And, you know, it's a California is a unique state. And I don't want people to think sometimes I talk about, you know, things that are happening in California, and I'm talking about it because they're the exception. But this is just a horribly bad idea. I think California is working a piece of legislation through the legislature. It passed the Senate and is in the Assembly right now, that would basically require the Department of Corrections to place individuals in facilities, male or female, prison facilities, based solely on their gender identity. So what they purport to be, you know, doesn't take into consideration a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, any mental health diagnosis, their anatomy, you know, a history of violent crimes, nothing other than just their claim of being a certain gender identity. And then they're placed in a prison based on that. And they argue that this is needed because there's higher rates of sexual assault against transgender inmates, which, you know, studies have found that's true. But they're basically attacking a very small, narrow problem with a solution that critics argue will put incarcerated women especially at just substantial risk if men are allowed into prisons, basically.
That's a really, really, really bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because like Britain had a similar law that came on the books, you know, a year and a half ago or so, and it just has been a mess. And they've tried to figure out how to do this well. You know, there's been cases. There was a case of a transgender individual, a man who identified as a woman who was put in a woman's prison and then sexually assaulted multiple women. And so because of the kind of backlash against this, they've now created a transgender unit. And during the testimony, I was watching the testimony for this bill. One of the assembly members said, you know, should we learn from this? You know, maybe we should learn from Britain. We should think about something like that. And the sponsor of the bill was just really adamant that, you know, transgender individuals are the gender that they claim to be. There is no, you know, distinction. They shouldn't be placed in a separate unit, and really refused to acknowledge that this could be manipulated by anyone for bad purposes, like that no one would ever go in and say, I'm going to say I'm a woman so that I could be put in the women's prison and have access to women, you know, just wouldn't acknowledge that could even be a possibility when we're talking about criminals here already. Yes. You know?
Yes. And prisons are such a complicated place to start with.
Oh, so complicated. And these issues, like I say, and we've talked about, I mean, they really are hard and complex because there are truly people who struggle with the diagnosis of gender dysphoria. And I can only imagine prison is a very difficult place to be. And then layer on top of that, that diagnosis. So this is a true issue, but this solution of just saying across the board, we're going to require staff at prison facilities to just ask someone, what do you identify as? And then to house them in that facility, just the ripple effects from that could be really awful, especially for women, you know, who are vulnerable already, incarcerated women. So,
all right, Kylie, let's leave California and go to the opposite direction. Let's go east to New York. Interesting. I think you wrote about a surrogacy bill that was talk about that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think there was an expectation across the board that this would pass. You know, New York is one of the only states in the country that explicitly has laws on the books that don't allow commercial surrogacy. So don't allow surrogacy for pay, basically.
You know, talk about what commercial surrogacy is for our listeners. Yeah. Just remind them.
Yeah. So if you offer to carry a child for someone just out of the goodness of your heart and are not compensated for it, that is called altruistic surrogacy. So in most cases, it's complicated how it all happens, but someone would usually do an in vitro fertilization process and then implant an embryo in a woman who has offered to carry the baby. Mm-hmm. And if they are not compensated for it, that's altruistic surrogacy. Commercial surrogacy is where you can actually kind of in a marketplace, look for a woman, you know, pay for all her medical bills, compensate her for that process, you know, require certain things of her during the process, you know, all sorts of things. And then once the baby's born, it's the legal custody of the intended parents, not the surrogate. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of moral and ethical issues that come from, lots of questions that come out of surrogacy. But surprisingly, New York is one of the only states that bans it, commercial surrogacy. Some states don't have laws at all, and so it's kind of a wild west. You know, other states allow for it in certain situations, but New York has said no, not at all. And this year, there was efforts to repeal that and to create a law that would kind of regulate a surrogacy market in New York. And the governor was on board, and you know, all sorts of high profile people were supporting it, and everyone thought for sure this is going to pass. No questions asked. This is New York. This is going to pass. And surprisingly, it didn't, because there was this uprising, mostly from Christians, ethicists, and then feminists, who argued that commercial surrogacy really turns a woman's body into a commodity, and that it can often coerce poor women to participate in surrogacy for the payout. And they were arguing that surrogacy does pose a lot of health risks, both to the woman and to the child. And so this pushback basically found an audience. And there was a number of especially female assembly members who said they wouldn't vote for it. And so it didn't pass in New York. And it was a big surprise, I think, to a lot of people who just expected that this would happen. Mm-hmm. Especially amongst the LGBT community, surrogacy, you know, is a very popular way of people making families. And so there was just this assumption that this was going to go through, and it didn't, because these people really pushed back on the ethics of, is this, Is this really good for women? Is this really good for children?
Wow. You know, Kylie, one of the things that I don't know if we talk about enough is just God's design for sexuality. And I think there was a study recently from the Institute for Family Studies. Mm-hmm. What can that tell us?
Yeah. I love when a study affirms what the Bible says is true and what God says, you know, what he intends for us in marriage and family. It's just so encouraging when you look at studies and you go, yes. So the Institute for Family Studies did, basically they did a study to look at, is religion good for couples? Like across the board, are religious couples, you know, and this is not explicitly Christian, mm-hmm. But are religious couples happier, healthier, you know? And what they found is almost always across the board, yes. Especially religious couples where they both share a strong faith are much happier, they're healthier, their relationships are marked by commitment and stability and attachment. Especially the women are more sexually satisfied. They report to being more satisfied relationally, much more so than either secular couples or couples where one partner is religious and one is not. So across the board, couples where both of them, you know, had the same faith, just the study found that they were happier, healthier, more satisfied in their relationship. So it was just a really interesting study that kind of points to this reality that, you know, forgiveness, you know, good community around you, this intent to stay faithful to each other, you know, all these things that religion encourages, that those are actually good for couples, good for relationships, good for marriage.
It's hard to think that your good-looking husband would, you know, if he didn't agree with what you held most sacred in life, your Christian deeply held values, how you would have a, you know, the best relationship going forward. You know, it's that unequally yoked concept in Scripture that is so real.
And what's interesting is, I mean, especially when looking at, I think it was like, I'm trying to remember, sexual satisfaction or relational satisfaction. The highest was jointly religious couples. The next was jointly secular couples. And at the very bottom was these couples that were mixed between one religious and one non-religious. And almost in every question they asked, that group came in lower than the other two. So even just that unity factor of like being on the same page, even if it was even atheists, united atheists came out in a lot of these statistics better than a couple where they disagreed on faith.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the idea that floods our society today is that freedom from religion is the key to a fulfilling relationship.
Right.
Lie.
The sexual ethic that, oh, throw out all the rules. You're going to be happy sexually if you don't, you know, kind of fall under all these oppressive religious ideas. And instead, you know, the women most satisfied in their sexual relationship. I mean, it was like nearly 50% that were religious said they were satisfied compared to like secular, it was 32%. So, I mean, a significant jump for women who are religious compared to not. And that's just not at all what we see in, you know, I mean, what's the last rom-com that you saw that was talking about how happily married and sexually satisfied religious couples were?
Right. Kylie Crossland is my guest. Go to world.wng.org to see all of her writing. world.wng.org. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back with Kylie in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. My guest is Kylie Crossland. She's a writer for World News Group. And you go to world.wng.org and you can see all kinds of her writing. She's got lots and lots and lots of stories up. Kylie, here's a couple of words I never thought I'd hear together. Posthumous reproduction.
Yes. I think a lot of people haven't heard those two words together, but I think they might. They might more in the future.
Explain what this is and how a judge ruled recently about this 21-year-old boy that died.
Yeah. The story is kind of a helpful example of how it works. So very tragically, a 21-year-old West Point cadet passed away in February. in a skiing accident, and his parents basically petitioned a court for a right to retrieve his sperm and then freeze it and then use it to create a child. So it would be their grandchild. And a judge in May in New York State ruled that they could do this. And I think it kind of brought the issue to light. There's been a few other cases of posthumous reproduction and like people asking for a right to retrieve sperms or eggs posthumously and then use them for reproduction. But I think this case kind of brought it to light and brought out a lot of the questions surrounding, you know, there's so much developing right now when it comes to artificial reproductive technology, you know, just our ability to understand conception and reproduction, to deal with eggs and sperm, you know, all these things are growing. And yet I think a lot of people are saying, wait, instead of just asking, what can we do? We need to be asking, what should we do? And should we be doing, you know, all the things that we're doing? But this ruling was really interesting because he basically said he couldn't find anything on the books that would say they couldn't. And so then he said, well, I guess you can.
I don't know how to respond right now.
Yeah.
I mean, what have you had in terms of conversation with people? What's their response to this?
Yeah. Well, I think there's like a couple responses. So I think one of the larger ethical issues is just, should we be allowing people to create, fatherless or motherless children? Mm-hmm. So, you know, adoption responds to the tragedy of a child losing a parent. Well, that should never happen. And so what posthumous reproduction does is it actually creates a child who is born without a father or mother intentionally. And so there's all sorts of ethical issues that flow from that. And, you know, someone who is denied a right to ever know their biological mother or father. But even if you grant that some people should be allowed to do this, in this specific case, this young man never gave his consent for such a procedure to happen. I mean, you know, he died, you know, very surprisingly, not knowing this was going to happen. He obviously assumed he wasn't going to die at 21. And so, you know, there's some people who would argue you should be allowed to use posthumous reproduction if someone gives their consent before they die in writing that, you know, after they die, they consent to their, you know, sperm or eggs being retrieved. And there's some questions about this with like military members. So there's a bill in Congress right now that would allow military members who are going to be deployed to give consent for posthumous egg and sperm retrieval. So that's like another issue altogether. But even if you grant this should be happening, you know, he didn't give his consent to let this happen. But I think it is interesting that there's these larger questions of, should this be even happening at all? You know, we have the power to do this because we have the technology now where this, you know, elderly couple can, well, I don't know if they're elderly, their son's only 21, but this couple can, you know, retrieve his sperm, freeze his sperm, hire, you know, buy eggs on the market. They can buy, you know, female eggs on the market. There's a market for that. They can have the in vitro fertilization process happen in a fertility clinic, and then they can buy a surrogate to carry the baby and deliver it. So there's this market, this almost complete market, where you can really purchase a child. And that just screams with ethical issues.
Well, Kylie, I can't say that I paid great attention in biology class, but when you say sperm or egg retrieval, what does that mean? Does that mean this poor 21-year-old boy has died from the skiing accident and then they went and retrieved sperm?
Yes. Yep. And they can do that. I mean, there's a very short window. And so that was one of the things right away. They, submitted an order for a judge, like to quickly rule whether or not they could immediately retrieve it. I think it was within the first 48 hours of his death.
Okay.
And then they froze it. And then this latest ruling in May was about whether or not they could use it themselves, like whether or not they kind of had a right to it, which is a whole nother question. But just God's intention, you know, designing us for marriage and for sex to create children. I mean, we're just really taking more and more steps away from that when it comes to creating life. And I think there are a lot of ethical issues that people just aren't thinking about when it comes to these things.
Now, I'm obviously concerned, and I know you write about this, the surge in suicide among young kids, especially girls, and you were seeing this more in the 10 to 14 year old range. Very disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really tragic. You know, that there's been a number of studies in the last couple of years that I've reported on that have talked about spikes in suicide for young people, preteens and teens. This was just a recent study that came out from the CDC looking at suicide rates among girls ages 10 to 14, like you said. And basically, you know, young boys are more likely to take their life than girls. But what they're finding is that girls are catching up, which is tragic and disturbing. The rise from 2007 to 2016 of girls taking their life was a 13% increase compared to just a 7% increase for boys. So girls kind of doubled the increase, even though the number is still less than boys. The surge was, you know, stronger. And so it's a horribly tragic statistic, I mean, an awful thing. And so I think a lot of people are looking at it and wondering what's going on. I mean, what's happening in these girls' lives, these 10 to 14 year olds, that would motivate this. And some people are pointing to social media, as just, it's, the reality is, you know, studies show girls use it more frequently, are on social media more frequently, and are just more vulnerable to kind of the isolation, the anxiety, the depression that can come from social media use. The bullying, all of those things, comparing, you know, body image, all the things that come from just being buried in this social media world where someone's perception of you, they're like, they're non-like, you know, all of those things really is what you live for, that just leads to a lot of depression and anxiety that could lead to suicide. So the study didn't say that, you know, didn't give that as an explanation, definitely, because they don't know, but there are a bunch of experts following the study who looked at the results instead. I think it's probably social media.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you get bullied at school or you get picked on, when you get home, the bullies are there waiting for you, because
yes,
if you open your computer or your phone and you go on social media and you're still getting bullied, there's no reprieve. There's no chance for these students or these young girls or boys to be built up again and be reinforced as
right,
to who they are in Christ by their family. And it's 24/7, Kylie.
Yeah, Bill, that's a great point. It is. It's 24/7 and there's no escape. And, you know, this kind of vision of these kids just like sleeping with their phones at home, you know, always hearing them going off, these notifications coming on their phones all the time. There's just this constant bombardment and they really can't escape from it. So you're right. There is no like, well, school's hard, but home is a respite. It's like, well, home, I have my phone and all the things that all the people that are bullying me still bullying me at home too.
Yeah, that's how do we get on the other side of this? What do we do? Because, I mean, kids, their phones are their lifeline.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, and I've reported on, there is a pushback, this kind of movement of parents who are saying, I'm not going to give my kid a smartphone. And I know that they're going to feel like they're being denied. I know that people are going to say it's less safe, you know, because nowadays they say, oh, it's for emergencies. But I do think that there's more and more parents. I mean, my son is 3, so we're not yet into the, you know, we're not wondering if we should give him a smartphone right now. But we are starting to think about down the road, like, are we willing to be unpopular and say, we don't think this is good for you. Mm-hmm. You know, we want you to experience childhood apart from this small device tethered to you all the time. And I think that there's more and more parents who are there's this kind of wait until eight. I'm forgetting the name of it, but it was a campaign I wrote about of parents who are rallying a group of parents in a certain classroom. So kind of to provide solidarity to say, hey, you and 5 of your friends are all in the same boat. None of you guys are getting phones until after the 8th grade. Just trying to delay this and say, you know what? Kids do not need phones as early as we say they do.
Yeah.
And they're not good for them.
Yeah. Kylie, thank you so much for doing the show. I always love talking to you.
And Bill, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, Kylie Crossland has been my guest. You go to world.wng.org. That's the website for the World News Group. And you can learn and read all kinds of articles that Kylie has written. We're going to take a very short break, and we come back Hour 2's ahead with Dr. Alex McFarland. Can't wait. Be back in a few minutes. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.